Chapter 8. It was probably a good thing that Purgatory was going to be placed under quarantine, because otherwise, I shudder to think what would have happened to the nomads. Humanity would have descended upon them with a vengeance. Already, we had started dumping our garbage on their world. We'd brought in some of our dirtiest industries, our most toxic wastes, and given time, we would have started exporting our most undesirable product. People. True, there were already people on Purgatory, but they were there only for the money, and they didn't really give a damn about the natives. That made them far less dangerous than the ones who would have really cared about the nomads. The lure would have been irresistible. Here were the savages to civilize, primitives to save. We have always been real big on saving. We've been saving each other for centuries, and considering how seriously we'd been at it, you'd think we'd have gotten the whole job done by now. But we hadn't, particularly because the various savers could never get their act together collectively, which was, you'll pardon the expression, a blessing. And partly because some of us didn't feel like being saved. But there were very few of us who seemed at peace simply being the way we were. The sad fact was that most of us required answers to some of life's more complicated questions, and it was upsetting to hear that in a complex world, there were no simple answers. Simple answers were infinitely more attractive. You could get more people to listen to a simple answer, because a complex one confused them, and their attention span was ludicrously short at best. So keep it simple. Set your hook and reel them in. Clearly, the nomads needed saving. They needed the benefits of our civilizing influence and our spiritual guidance. Their lives were elegantly in harmony with their surroundings. Something was obviously wrong here. What they needed was modern clothing, box warren apartments, mass transit, fast food, and biochips. In time, we would have given it all to them, and in the process, taken away their culture and their land. The ambimorphs were probably the best thing that ever happened to them. This was seditious thinking for a man in my position, a psychic cog in the machine of the multinational overmind. But then, I was a reluctant cog at best, and the fact that I was still able to think seditious thoughts was one of the few things that kept me sane. But, unless you had all the sensitivity of a real estate developer, it was hard not to think such thoughts when confronted with the lifeway of the nomads. Their camp was in a high valley ringed by mountains, and as we descended the trail that led down to the verdant valley floor, winding along a swiftly flowing river fed by a roaring cataract, it felt as if we were stepping back in time to a period in Earth's prehistory. Their houses, low dome-shaped shelters made of hides and scrub thatch, brought to mind some old Celtic village from the Bronze Age. The dwellings were spaced fairly wide apart in a rough circle around a larger central structure that was probably used for tribal meetings. A crude sort of earthworks had been thrown up around the camp, which seemed to indicate some competition amongst the tribes. Or perhaps it was only there to keep the beasties out. We went in through the main gate and immediately became the center of attention as the entire tribe turned out to look us over. All the cliched expressions sprang to mind as I returned their scrutiny. Noble savages, fierce pride, primitive grandeur, and all that. But the truth was that none of those expressions really did the nomads justice. Imagine a cross between Crazy Horse and Lucifer. The result would be something both magnificent and frightening. The result would be a purgatory nomad. As Higgins had already explained, nomad was our term for them. They thought of themselves in terms of their tribal identities. Tyla's tribe was the Dailaken. Higgins explained that this name translated roughly as Dyla's people. They took the name from their tribal matriarch, Tyla's grandmother, and her mother before her, and so on. If Dyla were to die, then Tyla's mother, Noli, was the next in line, and at a sort of ceremony of investiture, she would add to her birth name the name of the matriarch, though she would all be addressed only as Dyla. Eventually, Tyla would also take on the name, using it as a prefix to her own. In this manner, the name had become a sort of title. However, names among the nomads played a more colorful and descriptive role than among humans, and apparently things could get a little complicated. Birth names were usually short and simple, chosen from among family names, but from there, it was anything goes. The next set of names a nomad was saddled with depended on some significant or possibly even an amusing incident in his or her young life. Gar, for example, was actually Kol Ap Gar Hawk Altani, which Higgins translated as Kol, small killer of large stones. There was, of course, a story that went along with this, as there was a story that went along with every nomad name. It seemed that when he was a child, Gar, then known only by his birth name, Kol, had been playing hunter with some other children and had attacked a fairly good-sized boulder, pretending that it was some local equivalent of a woolly mammoth or something. He had struck it in a strong two-handed blow with a stone axe belonging to one of his father's, and the shock traveling up his arms had put him on his ass and made his head spin. However, he must have struck the boulder on the exact spot of a flaw, because the damn thing cracked and split apart, enhancing his reputation to no end among his playmates. Hence, Kol Ap Gar Hawk Altani, Kol, small killer of large stones, which he had informally shortened to Gar, which meant simply killer, a name with a considerably more ominous interpretation. But given his size, apparently no one felt inclined to nitpick. I learned all this, and a few other pertinent bits of information, while we waited in the large central structure for the tribal meeting to formally convene. Everyone, or most everyone, it seemed, was already there, and we were now waiting on the matriarch, who was being fashionably late. I half expected to hear a skirling of wood flutes or a roll of hide-covered drums announcing her arrival, which I guessed would be in some sort of a sedan chair. I was surprised instead when a nomad female who didn't appear much older than Tyla walked in, without ceremony, and sat down cross-legged on the ground, about 15 feet away from the fire pit dug in the center. At once, the other members of the tribe gathered on either side of her, forming a circle around the fire pit, which we were meant to join. We sat down, and the fire was lit. I stared across the flames at Dyla, the matriarch of Tyla's tribe. She was dressed simply, in the same short animal hide skirt worn by other females, and her hair was more silver than dark. For a grandmother, she wore her years extremely well. But then, what was old for a nomad? I had no idea. I'd have to remember to ask Higgins. At the moment, instinct told me to keep my mouth shut, because everyone else was being quiet, and you could cut the silence with a knife. Ever sit in the same room with about 100 people and have absolutely no one make a sound? Well, perhaps in church, but even in church, people tend to cough and shift around and rustle hymn books, and there's always at least one anarchist who breaks wind loudly enough to shake the rafters. This was serious silence. Nobody moved. Nobody breathed. Then Dyla started speaking. Her voice wasn't very loud, but it was firm and full of confident authority. She exchanged a few words of greeting with her granddaughter. Then she spoke briefly to Higgins, who replied in her own language. I don't know what was said, but she seemed to regard him with the patient approval of a teacher toward a pupil who was making progress. Then she turned to look at us, and even from a distance of about 20 feet, that golden stare was difficult to deal with. I felt as if a fuzzy caterpillar were crawling around inside the back of my head, tickling the gray matter as they slithered across my mind. I didn't know if I was really feeling that, or if I was just imagining I felt that. Was the feeling self-induced by an attack of paranoia, or was it something she was doing to me? Or was it something that evil bastard Mondigo was doing to me back at game control? I couldn't tell, and that was scaring me. These little anxiety attacks were coming more and more frequently lately, and the fact that I'd managed to keep it all together so far wasn't all that reassuring. I knew only too well that the breakdown rate among psychos was phenomenally high. My morbid curiosity had led me to investigate a number of those cases. In each of them, anxiety attacks and a growing sense of paranoia increased exponentially until the mind went boom. And it seemed no one was really certain what happened after that, where those poor bastards disappeared to, or what was done with them. In fact, The idea of the mind going boom raised a very nasty question. Could that happen literally? Could Coles have slipped a microscopic bomb into my brain that would explode upon a reception of a certain coded tachyon signal? Or would he ever need to do that? Could he get into my driver's seat and make me shoot myself, or dive headlong off a cliff, or beat my head against the ground until it turned to jelly? I suddenly realized that I had drifted off into another paranoid fantasy, a sort of mini-fugue, a real doozy this time. I blinked and shook my head to clear it. Dyla was still staring at me without expression. Jesus, how long had I been sitting there, glassy-eyed and slack-jawed, thinking those nightmarish thoughts? I shot a sidelong glance at Breck and saw that he was staring straight ahead, sitting perfectly still, completely motionless, except for a slight tick at the corner of his mouth. I opened my mouth to say his name, but I couldn't seem to do much more than part my lips slightly and make very faint croaking sounds. I felt sweat trickling down my back. What the hell was happening here? A horrifying idea occurred to me, a terrible suspicion that Dyla was not a nomad at all, but an ambimorph, that they were all ambimorphs, that Higgins had led us into a trap, and that he was one of them. And in a moment, they were going to start turning into giant snakes and slithering towards us, their jaws unhinged, fangs gleaming, dripping poison. And suddenly, the fear was gone. Bam! Just like that. Vanished in an instant. And I was staring into the flames of the crackling fire in the pit, seeing forms moving in the background through a veil of heat shimmers. My time sense was confused again. My vision was a little blurry. It seemed very, very warm. The flames were dancing, and the heat shimmers above them were dancing, and the figures beyond them were dancing, and there were strange sounds filling the air. The ethereal, high-pitched whistling whine of bone flutes, like the cries of seagulls on the wind. For a moment, I thought I heard Mondego calling me, but it was only a distant echo in my mind that dissipated in that haunting, bird-like music. A young nomad female stood before me, looking down at me, legs spread apart, hips rolling gently, arms hanging straight down at her sides, fingers spread rigidly apart. Her head was inclined toward me, and her jet-black hair hung long and loose down to her waist, only partially covering her naked breasts. She was wearing nothing except a sort of brief animal-hide loincloth, and her golden skin gleamed with a sheen of perspiration. Her lips were slightly parted, and I could see the tips of her two large, pointed canine teeth. Her eyes were like yellow gold in firelight. Several other couples were dancing slowly around the fire, moving in a sort of surreal minuet to the intertwining, whistling melodies of the bone flutes, a cacophony of sounds like a bird chorus coming from a distance, as if heard from across a lake. The couples didn't touch. They stood close to one another, undulating gently, swaying like trees bending in the wind, almost touching, then rolling back, and moving in, and circling slightly, then almost touching once again. The nomad girl reached out and pulled me to my feet. I stood and started imitating her movements, a little awkwardly at first, then falling into the rhythm of the bone flutes, their rising and falling whistles having a sort of ebb and flow, like surf crashing on a distant shore. Her gaze was locked with mine, and I couldn't look away. Nor did I want to. The smoke from the fire filled the interior of the lodge, making my eyes smart. The temperature kept rising. In minutes, it seemed, I was soaked with sweat. The wood they were burning had some sort of pungent, musky scent. Or was that her scent? That somehow made me think of the frankincense burned by the Russian Orthodox... Okay. That somehow made me think of the frankincense burned by the Russian Orthodox archbishops of my ancestors during their somber, melancholy services. I almost seemed to hear them chanting in their ancient church Slavonic, the basso profundo voices of the deacons rising up from deep in my subconscious, memories rising not from me, but through me, from all those who had gone before me, from the long-suffering peasants on my mother's side to the pagan Celts on my father's. The Byzantine intonations of the bishops seemed to segue into the stentorian, guttural chanting of white-robed druid priests, marching slowly in torchlit procession to an altar set in the center of a circle of high stones. A pale-limbed girl with hair as red as fire was held down on the slab, her green eyes wide with terror as the crude stone knife was raised. And her sharp claws raked across my chest, leaving thin red trails that wept blood. I was naked, on my back, with a nomad girl straddling me, her long, coarse hair, like a horse's mane, whipping me as she rolled her head with each savage thrust of her hips. Her hands gripped my shoulders, and I felt her claws breaking my skin, digging deep, and I screamed, though not only with pain, a scream that seemed to catch somewhere in my throat, and sound only in my mind, echoing inside my head and bouncing off a cacophony of images from a past that was completely alien to me, and yet, at the same time, hauntingly familiar.
"Guten Tag," Breck said. "How's the newly fed?"
I opened my eyes and saw him sitting cross-legged beside the pile of furs I lay on, a mocking smile on his face.
"What?"
I croaked, my voice sounding hideous. I tried to push myself up, but I collapsed almost immediately. My entire body was sore. I felt as if I'd run a marathon and then been forced to turn around and do it all again because I hadn't done it fast enough. I felt as if I'd gone 8 rounds with the heavyweight champion of the world with my hands tied behind my back. I felt as if I'd been... Jesus! I sat bolt upright, and the entire room started spinning. Breck caught me and steadied me with his arm around my shoulders.
"Is this there, son?" he said. "You'd best take things a little slowly for a while."
I looked down at myself and immediately squeezed my eyes shut. I was stark naked, and my chest and thighs were covered with claw marks. My hips were bruised, and there were thin trails of dried blood caked on my stomach. I looked as if I'd been mauled by a leopard. Actually, not exactly mauled, but...
"Oh, God,"
I groaned.
"Don't tell me."
"One of these days, O'Toole, you'll have to explain to me about this attraction you seem to have for savage, predatory females."
Breck pursed his lips thoughtfully.
"Perhaps you appeal to their maternal instincts."
"What the hell happened?"
I managed to croak.
"You mean you really don't remember?"
"God damn it, Breck. This isn't funny."
I looked around at the inside of the tiny lodge.
"Where the hell are we?"
"Your honeymoon suite, it seems,"
said Breck.
"Tyler's family was gracious enough to loan it to you, seeing as how you married her little sister when you did the mating dance with her last night."
I groaned again and fell back on the furs, pulling them up over me.
"Oh, Jesus, I can't believe it. Where the hell were you all the time this was happening? Why the hell didn't you stop me?"
Breck shrugged.
"Well, after all, you are over 21, and I didn't really think it was my place to interfere."
"So help me, Breck. If I had enough energy to make a fist, I'd punch you in the mouth,"
I said weakly.
"All right, I'm sorry,"
Breck said with a smile.
"But you must admit that this situation is not without its comedic aspect."
"Notice I'm not laughing."
"Duly noted,"
Breck said.
"In fact, I couldn't have stopped what happened any more than you could. I've had a rather busy night myself, if not quite as active."
He smirked, then caught himself.
"Sorry. Actually, your new wife is extremely concerned about you. Tally is young and apparently very energetic. She was afraid she might have killed you. She's with Tyler and Higgins at the moment, being instructed in the proper care and treatment of her fragile human spouse."
"You really find this amusing, don't you, you miserable bastard?"
I said.
"Where are my clothes?"
Wordlessly, he held up what was left of my shirt. It was in tatters. His mouth started to twitch, and he struggled to keep it contained. But it was too much for him, and he lost it, dissolving into laughter. I wanted to kill him. A moment later, he got himself back under control.
I'm sorry, O'Toole, he said, shaking his head. I truly am. It's just that...
He started to laugh once more, but this time he managed to fight it down. He looked away, cleared his throat, took several deep breaths, and turned back to me again.
We really do have much to talk about, he said.
Damn you, I said. You should have done something. I simply can't believe it. I remember some of what happened, but it's as if I've been drugged or something. Breck, I can't be married. You have to tell Higgins. He's got to explain it to... What's her name again?
You can't, said Breck.
Damn it, Breck.
Her name is Tali, he said. And you can explain things to her yourself. She can speak English after a fashion.
She what?
Here, said Breck, tossing me some hides. Put these on while I go get you some breakfast. Although she finds the idea quite appalling, Tali has actually agreed to burn some meat for you. Even Higgins is impressed. In this culture, that's akin to a princess agreeing to debase herself before the coachman. She must really like you. There must be more to you than meets the eye.
I glared at him as he went out to get me something to eat, and then I started dressing in the hides he'd left me. When I was done, I looked absurd, as if I were on my way to a masquerade party. I was in fairly good shape, but in the outsized hides, I looked like some sort of undernourished caveman. Or perhaps a cyberpunk in drag. A few moments later, Breck came back with some food, which he had promised we would eat out of sight of the nomads. Higgins, it seemed, ever the complete xenobiologist, had learned to eat his meat raw with the other males.
I've heard from Montego, Breck said, as he bit into his roast beast. He's been absolutely frantic, and Coles is in a state as well. It seems they couldn't get in touch with us. Mondego kept trying repeatedly, but he could not establish contact.
I seem to remember Mondego calling to me last night, I said. During the tribal meeting or ceremony or whatever it was.
Did it sound as if he were calling from a great distance, his voice sort of muffled?
More like a distant echo, I said. Then it wasn't just my imagination.
Breck shook his head.
Nine, I heard it too. And after a while, it sort of faded away. They blocked him out, you see.
I frowned. What do you mean they blocked him out? And then it sank in suddenly, and my jaw dropped as I stared at Breck with disbelief.
They blocked him out?
Breck nodded.
I didn't really understand it, but it seems that what the nomads did was to telepathically insulate our minds, effectively jamming the tachyon broadcast and reception.
But how?
I said, astonished.
That, said Breck, is what our friend Coles would give his right arm to know.
Did Higgins know about this?
How would he know? The nomads have never been confronted with biochips before. He knew about their being telepathic, though.
Breck grimaced.
It seems he neglected to inform us of that little detail.
I shook my head.
I don't understand.
It's simple enough, said Breck. He's on their side. Not against us specifically, but against what's being done on Purgatory. When he realized that we could help him.
So this whole thing about Ambermorse playing gods amongst the nomads was a setup?
Breck shook his head.
Nine. He claims that's real enough. And Dyla backs him up. I spent most of last night talking with them. It was absolutely fascinating. I wish you could have been there. But you've, otherwise engaged.
Don't start, I said, pointing at him. He grinned.
Have some meat. You need to keep your strength up.
Very funny. I'm still waiting for you to explain what this is all about. What does Higgins think we can do for him? Where do the Ambermorphs fit in? And why the hell was it necessary for me to marry
Tali?
Breck prompted.
Yeah, I said, feeling my face flush.
It couldn't have just been my boyish charm. Compared to the other males around here, I'm downright anemic. So why?
At the risk of wounding your tender ego, Breck said. It was not love at first sight. It has to do with their customs and traditions, which require sexual bonding in order to... Well, it's rather complicated. I'll explain it to you later. For the moment, let's simply say that the reasons for your marriage were primarily political, although Tali does seem to have taken to you. But you need not concern yourself. It's a serious matter, to be sure, but it isn't quite the same as marriage in our society, as Higgins has already pointed out. In fact, Tali has something like 15 husbands already.
15?
I understand that's a conservative number for a female in her position. She's been groomed to take her place in the matriarchy, along with Tyler,
Breck explained,
and to accept responsibilities far greater than any matriarch has ever had to undertake before. Which is why she's been learning English telepathically from Higgins, sort of on the principle of know your enemy.
Meaning us, I said.
Meaning us. It seems we were never learned from our mistakes. We underestimated the creatures we found on Draconis 9, but now we've done the same thing with the nomads. We wrote them off as primitive nomadic tribes, semi-sentient savages at best. Of no great interest to us, because we had nothing to learn from them, and all they had that we wanted was their real estate.
Instead, it turns out that they're the biggest threat to Psychodrome's mind control monopoly, I said. Looks like Coles has finally met its match. He can't push their buttons. Nor can he push ours if they don't want him to. They decided to cut him off and that was that. They simply pulled the plug. And then it hit me. I took a deep breath and let it out slowly. My God, Breck. They really did pull the plug. On themselves. They're already in the way of the greedy bastards who want to come in and rape this planet. And Higgins thought that he was helping them by bringing us here? Hell, we've just hammered the last nail into their coffin. Any reason Coles could have possibly had for helping out the nomads disappeared the moment he found out that they could beat the biochip with just a thought. That makes them almost as great a threat as the Ambimorphs.
Perhaps it would. Except for one thing,
Breck said.
Well, two things, actually. The first is that the nomads are not hostile, and they're not interested in threatening Coles or anybody else. They'd really much rather we went away and left them the hell alone. However, they wouldn't have much to bargain with if it wasn't for the second thing.
And that is?
They can detect Ambimorphs,
said Breck. End of chapter.